experimenting, playing with a couple things here, just trying to figure out how much lag time there is between when I initiate a live stream with my equipment here and when it actually sort of catches and goes live for you guys. I'm monitoring how long it takes here on the church's website. So we do have a third way to watch, not only on YouTube and Facebook, but also on the church's webpage, assuming things are working properly, etc. So we want to welcome all of you to class this morning. Those of you that are here in person, looks like we might have a little bit of a light crowd. I forgot to hang up my coat, so I'm going to take care of this quick. All right, so everybody should have a set of notes in front of them for lesson 163. And it looks like we are live now, so that did... I don't know if I have to refresh this or not, but... Oh, there it is, live. Okay, so everything does appear to be working. This is only the second week that I've tried to do this in this way, and so I just wanted to check on things. If you look at the church's website, those of you that are joining us, if you're on YouTube, I think there's a link under here. If not, you can go to the church's website, just straight gracelifebiblechurch.com. And we're on lesson 163 right here on January 16. And you can go ahead and click that and open the notes and follow along with us as we have this particular lesson. So lesson 163, and the title of it is The Work in Progress Documents, Analyzing the Pre-1611 Evidence for the Text, Part 2. So this is Part 2 of what we started last week. And if you recall, last week we didn't finish everything. And I said we were going to move some of that now into this lesson, or the study for this week, which is Lesson 163. Now, I just want to say as a housekeeping issue here as we get started with this lesson that there's some stuff in this lesson that I did not know about until this week. And it has proven to be a very interesting week for me. It's been a busy week for me. I had three messages or studies to prepare for this week. I had the memorial service yesterday, and then this class today, and then our annual meeting here following this in the main session or the main hour. So there's a lot of stuff, but a lot of things have come to my attention this week that have definitely been enlightening, and we'll be talking about those here, some of those things here in this lesson and then in the next couple. So somebody asked me if I know from week to week where I'm going. And the answer to that is yes. But I have a lesson started now already for like the third week in February. So when I take the summer off to read and get going, I'm actually starting to write lessons in advance because I know that if I wait until school starts and so on and so forth, then if I start then, I'm done. I'm never going to get this stuff done. So I start this in the summer and laying things out, but things always come to my attention as we kind of work our way through things, okay? So you have to kind of be open to that process. And it's definitely an ongoing process, but the next two lessons after this one are going to be based off of things that I've learned here recently, like within the last week, about these work in progress documents that I didn't even know maybe even 2 weeks ago, okay? So, the introduction, lesson 163, the work in progress documents, analyzing the pre-1611 evidence for the text, part two. Introduction, in lesson 161, we sought to establish a general timeline for how the various companies of translators conducted their work. We reviewed this last week in lesson 162. In general, we established the following working timeline. So I'm going to go ahead and present this now, the way I've been presenting it, and then in a few weeks I'm going to kind of present a more fuller picture of this based upon what we're going to cover in this lesson and a few others, okay? But this is still perfectly suitable for what we've been doing. So we've identified stage one as from 1604 to 1608, the six companies begin their work on the draft translations. They produce draft translations, okay? The Lambeth Palace manuscript that we talked about last week, manuscript 98, represents stage one. And Bod 1602, the second document we talked about last week, bridges the gap between manuscript 98 and the review at the general meetings. Now, there is good reason to believe that there's variation within BOD 1602, but some of the work captured in that is more middle of the road or middle of the process work, and some of it is more later sort of final work or end of the road work. We'll talk more about those things when we talk about that document in more detail in the future. Stage two is 1609 to 1610, which is the general meeting or meetings, where the review of the company, where they review the company drafts and they establish the text to be printed, and the notes of John Boyce bear witness to that process. And then stage three, we have noted here as 1611, and that is when the printing actually happens, and the two men, Thomas Pilson and Miles Smith, work with the king's printer, Robert Barker, to see the text through to the press. And then there are two different printings from 1611 that bear witness to the final decisions of the translators. Okay? So all that should be reviewed. So having established a general working timeline, last week in Lesson 162, we began considering the three work-in-progress documents in greater detail. While we have mentioned these in our studies thus far, they are all worthy of their own consideration. Once again, the three documents are Manuscript 98, BOD 1602, and the Notes of John Boyce. I started that last week. Over the next couple lessons, we will be considering each of the three primary work-in-progress documents in terms of the following points. Okay, we're going to be looking at number one, scholarly awareness and public access, published access. Number two, we're going to be looking at a physical description and the contents of it, what's in it, what's there. And then thirdly, we're going to be looking at how they impact the readings found in the King James Bible. So we only had time in Lesson 162 to look at point one, i.e. scholarly awareness and published access for Manuscript 98 and BOD 1602. So that's what we did last week in Lesson 162, right? In summation, we observed the following. I did want to capture this, though, in a way where we could kind of look at what we did last time and understand it. So first, Manuscript 98, in the possession of the Lambeth Palace Library, it is logged in the library for the first time in 1647. So it could have been there before that, but it is logged and cataloged as in their possession in 1647. All right? Now, the translation process happens between 1604 and 1611. So it's very possible that it could have been there before that. We don't know. We do know for sure that there's a log in the Lambeth Palace Library entering it into their possession in 1647. All right? Scholarly awareness. So that's the top of page two. Discovered by E.E. Willoughby in 1955, he briefly described and discussed in his 1956 monograph, The Making of the King James Bible, a monograph with comparisons from the Bishop's Bible and manuscript annotations of a 1602 with the original leaf from the Great She Bible of 1611. So this document is logged in the possession of the Lambeth Palace Library in 1647. Scholarly awareness of it is happening in 1955 with E.E. Willoughby. Willoughby goes through and he figures out what it is that this document represents. And he is going to, so it's 1955 that he realizes it. In 1956, he writes that book I showed you last week, that big, like, coffee table size book where he talks about that, that had that had an actual page from a 1611 in it. Remember, I showed you that last week, okay? So, this is Willoughby, and I am going to have to look at his name because I always spell it wrong. So, is it in the library's possession by 1647? No one realizes what it is until 1955, when Willoughby figures that out. He first writes about it for the first time in 1956. It's extremely brief. There's one picture. He discusses maybe a handful of readings, and that's it. All right? Look at the next part. Published access. In 1977, Ward Allen published Translating the New Testament Epistles, 1604 to 1611, a manuscript of King James's Westminster Company for Vanderbilt University Press. Now, I have that book. It is this one right here. Translating the New Testament Epistles by Ward Allen from 1977. This book is exceedingly rare. I could not find it. It was only through the help of another member of the body of Christ accessing it for me at Ohio State University that I have access to it. Okay? So that's 1977. So 1977 is when Allen is going to publish the New Testament Epistles. And I'm just going to keep that short. So he's going to publish the New Testament Epistles in 1977. So this first date here is when it's logged in the library. The second date is when there's scholarly awareness of it. The third date is when it is accessible through published access, namely Ward Allen's work here on translating the New Testament Epistles. And that is in 1977. So is everybody following what we're doing here? Okay? The next document is Bod 1602. This is the annotated copy of the Bishop's Bible in the possession of the Bodleian Library. So, the Annals of the Bodleian Library at Oxford, edited by William Dunn McCrae, notes receipt of this volume in 1646. So, this is logged into the possession of the Bodleian Library in 1646. So you'll notice, is there some commonality here? Are they being logged into the respective libraries at roughly the same time? Okay. Scholarly awareness. So again, guys, we're going to have to say, well, let's look at this. 19th century British scholars, B.F. Westcott in his 1863 book and Nicholas Pocock in 1888, wrote about the document but missed its true significance. And we studied that last week in Lesson 162, if you want the details. Alright? Once again, it was E.E. Willoughby in 1955 who realized that Bod 1602 comprised the draft work of the translators' companies, or the translation companies. So again, when we think about scholarly awareness, I should probably be a little bit more specific. There's awareness of it in 1863, documented awareness in 1863 from Westcott. Then again in 1888 by Pocock in the Athenaeum Journal. Again, we talked about that last week. But I'm going to make a note here. These guys, back in the 19th century, they didn't realize the true significance of the document. They know it's there, they know it's in the possession of the Bodleian Library, but they don't grasp the true meaning behind the document, okay? So again, it's Willoughby in 1955, and again in his 1956 book, where we're going to see the true awareness of what is in Bod 1602. You guys following that, okay? In 1975, Edward Carney Jacobs wrote an essay for the papers of the Bibliographical Society of America. Doesn't that sound like a fun group to be a part of? The Bibliographical Society of America, titled An Old Testament Copy Text for the 1611 Bible. And that is this essay right here that I pulled off of the University of Chicago Press Journal, and this first appears in 1975. Okay? And then if you read on with that, later in 1955, Jacobs co-authored The Coming of the King James Gospels, a collation of the translator's work in progress for the University of Arkansas Press with Ward S. Allen. This important volume provides complete collation of Bod 1602 and the 1611 text for the Gospels. And that is this book right here. Okay? So, as far as published access goes for Bod 1602, we actually have, I need to add an essay to that, which is Jacob's other essay, The Two Stages of Old Testament Translation for the King James Bible. I'm having a hard time determining the date on that one. It's not readily apparent to me. But the most access here is going to be in 1995 through the book published by Allen and Jacobs, which is a full collation of Bod 1602 for the Gospels, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. Okay? So, For the rest of this lesson, I would like to continue looking at these work in progress documents by considering scholarly awareness of published access for the notes of John Boyce. So before we get into the main point for today, I just want to reiterate, okay? So when you triangulate these dates of first entrance, scholarly awareness, and published access, you realize very quickly that the King James only writing that occurred in the 1950s and 60s and 70s is happening with, in many cases, number one, without even an awareness of these, and for sure with no working knowledge of them. In other words, they hadn't studied them, they didn't really know, and so they're saying things in some cases that aren't necessarily true because they're not aware of these documents. Now they are aware, now they're known, they've been studied. What I'm trying to do is bring attention to them and look at what they can tell us about what actually happened between 1604 and 1611. Now, I'm not attempting to just try your patience here unnecessarily. What I am trying to do is tell a full and complete story as possible about these things, okay? So does anybody have any questions about the review and the introduction? It was a little longer than normal, but none of that should be overly new. It should have been a review of things that we've already gone through. Any questions about that? Okay. Scholarly awareness and public access. So we're finishing now the first point. So if you go back to page one, and if you look at the bottom third, I said that we were going to look at three things for these documents. All right, what were we going to look at for these documents? Number one, we were going to look at scholarly awareness and published access. We've done that for Manuscript 98 and Bob 1602. We're about to do it right now for the notes of John Boyce. These other two points, a physical description and contents, we haven't gotten to that yet, and we have not yet talked about the impact of these documents on the readings found in the King James Bible. So we are still working on finishing scholarly awareness and published access for these three primary work in progress documents. Okay? So now if you go to page two, that's what we're doing right here with our main point for today. So, notes of John Boyce. The third work in progress document that garners our attention is the notes of John Boyce. This story is best told by Ward S. Allen, the discoverer of the document, in the preface to his 1967 publication, Translating for King James, Notes Taken by a Translator of the King James Bible. And folks, that is this book right here by Ward Allen, printed in 1969. Now you'll notice whose name is coming up three times now as granting public access to these, or published access to these documents. It's Ward Allen. He's associated with all three of them. Manuscript 98, Bob 1602, and the notes of John Boyce. Okay? So he's an important figure in all of this. So let's look at what he says about discovering the notes of Boyce. He says, quote, "The story of the publication of John Boyce's notes is a simple one. Some years ago, I learned through Dr. F.H.A. Scribner's book, The Authorized Edition of the English Bible, 1611, Cambridge University Press, 1884, that John Boyce, one of the translators of the authorized version, had made notes while the company of review, of which he was a member, prepared the final edition of their translation at Stationer's Hall during the years 1610-1611. Boyce, and he only, made notes as the company deliberated over the final version. For time, out of memory, the notes have been lost." So you follow that. He's saying there was sort of a general awareness of this, but the actual notes had not survived. They were not extant, nobody knew where they were. Okay? For one who beguiled leisure hours in puzzling over the revision that the translators made of the authorized version had formed in their edition out of previous translations, the dream of recovering the lost notes floated in unbodied joy. Dr. Scribner nourished the dream with the conjecture that someday lost notes would perhaps turn up in a private collection. Long after I had abandoned hope of glimpsing the notes forever, it happened that they fell my way full body. A photograph and some remarks on John Boyce and his notes in Gustavus S. Payne's book, The Learned Men, 1959, gave me hope that a true copy of the notes rested in the Bodleian Library. Mr. T.H. Ashton, the librarian of Corpus Christi College, Oxford, was kind enough to furnish me with a photographic copy of the manuscript from which Mr. Payne had described. A close study has convinced me that, here's the letters on this thing, MSCTC 312 exhibits substantially a section at least of the notes which John Boyce made at Stationer's Hall. The notes appear on 39 manuscript pages, 61 through 80, and are concerned with the problems of translating biblical passages from Romans through Revelation, with addenda covering 1 Corinthians through Revelation. I published a preliminary description of these notes in the Renaissance News, Winter 1966. Now, I know you all read the Renaissance News, right? I mean, doesn't everybody read the Renaissance News? No, I'm joking, okay? With the hope, so 1966, is he announcing to the scholarly world of what he thinks he's looking at here, okay? With the hope that if any scholars doubted the authenticity of the notes, they would make their doubts known. Several scholars, biblical, literary, and classical, were kind enough to write to me expressing their conviction that the notes which I had described and argued were indeed a good copy of the lost notes. The introduction to this book adds to the evidence in that article an elaborate study which has as its single end to demonstrate that the notes which are reproduced in this book are a good copy of those notes which John Boyce made at Stationer's Hall. Now notice, is he saying they're his original notes?
No.
No, he's saying they're a copy of them. Okay? So somebody copied his notes, that is what Allen is saying. Now, let's just look at this book just briefly. I'm just going to put it in front of the screen. Here's the way the book is formatted. On this page, you have a photograph of the actual notes, written in Greek, Latin, and some English, and then on the facing page you have an English translation of everything that's on this page. Okay? That's what we have in this book for 1969, translating for King James. So Ward Allen, not in the mid-1960s, does he discover the heretofore lost notes of John Boyce in the Bodleian Library in a cache of manuscript documents, and he publishes this book in 1969, and it has since been accepted by the literary world as a faithful copy of John Boyce's notes. Okay? Is everybody with me so far? So still on page 3. A second copy of Boyce's notes was discovered in the mid-1990s by Dr. David Norton. Norton wrote about this in his 1996 essay for the library titled John Boyce's Notes on the Revision of the King James Bible New Testament, a New Manuscript. And here is my copy of that essay. Okay? The notes and transcription found in Allen's, so that's the book, 1969 publication, are based upon a transcribed copy of Boyce's notes done by William Fulman, 1633 to 1688. A note found at the end of the copy, furnished by Allen, reads as follows, quote, transcribed out of a copy taken by some unskillful hand, very confused and faulty, especially in the Greek. Okay? So, that transcriber's note is saying that he is making a what?
Copy.
A copy. He's copying somebody else's copy, is essentially what he's saying. Alright? So, that's important to note that. Okay? Let's look at the next statement. Professor Norton believes that this statement does not apply to Boyce's work in note-taking. So in other words, is Fulman copying Boyce's notes directly, or is he copying a copy of Boyce's notes? He's copying a copy of Boyce's notes, okay? So the statement there, transcribed out of a copy taken by unskillful hand, very confused and faulty, especially in Greek, is not a statement about Boyce's skill and ability. It's about the skill and ability of the person whose notes he's copying. You following that? Okay? So again, bottom of page 3, Professor Norton believes that this statement does not apply to Boyce's work in note-taking or his understanding of Greek, but to the copy of his notes that Fulman used to make his transcription. Quote, top of page 4 from Norton, This does not diminish the general authenticity of the notes in that they clearly are Boyce's notes taken during the revision of the latter part of the New Testament. But it does create more doubts about their accuracy than if they were taken direct from Boyce's own manuscript. These doubts can only partially be laid to rest by the quality of the detail so well demonstrated by Allen in his notes. The discovery of Boyce's original autograph notes would be a real coup. So in other words, if we could find Boyce's original notes, that would obviously be the best thing we could do, right? But in the absence of finding Boyce's original notes, what would be the next best thing? The next best thing would be to find another copy. You guys following this? Okay? All of this implies the existence, obviously, of more than one copy of Boyce's notes. This is precisely what Norton found in the British Library. Quote, in the absence of the original, the next best thing is another copy. There is one in the British Library, manuscript Harley 750, folios 3 recto through 6 recto. It is the second item of a collection made by the cleric, eventually Bishop of Dunblane, James Waterburn. What I take to be Waterburn's hand begins on the same folio as the last of the notes. This copy dates from at least 1639 and is substantially older than Fulman's copy. So Norton, in his essay, he is describing now finding a second copy of Boyce's notes. All right? Based upon where he found them, whose manuscript, Waterburn's, they were in, he is saying that they have to date from at least 1639. Okay, now, I want to go to the end of this because I want to make a comparison for you. You need to visually see. Now, these pictures are also in your notes if you're in class with the... Here's... The following image is the Fulman transcript utilized by Ward Allen in his 1969 book Translating for King James. You'll notice again that if you look at that, that is the same format that we see. This is not the same page, but that's the same format we see here in the book. Okay? So this is the Fulman manuscript. The one known as Manuscript Harley 750 is this one. Manuscript Harley 750. The following is an image of the second known copy of the notes of John Boyce discovered in 1996 by Dr. David Norton. The document is in the possession of the British Library and is discussed in Dr. Norton's essay, John Boyce's Notes on the Revision of the King James Bible New Testament, a new manuscript, and again, that is this essay right here. Okay? Now notice, is the formatting different in Harley Manuscript 750 than it is in the Fulman manuscript? The formatting is different, right? So that means that Fulman, when he copied, is he laying it out differently than what we have in this one? Okay? Is everybody tracking with me here? Okay? So I think I'm just going to leave the images up and go back to the notes. Norton goes on to this, we already read that point, right? It was while looking for other notes related to the King James Bible that Norton discovered the heretofore uncataloged copy of Boyce's notes in manuscript Harl 750. I said Harley, it's Harl. He's not riding a Harley, okay? So, Norton is looking for documentation related to the King James Bible in the library. As he's going through this thing, he stumbles upon this. In studying it, he realizes that this is another copy of Boyce's notes that before that moment had never been cataloged and realized what that is. You follow me? Okay? So it was while looking for other notes related to the King James Bible that Norton discovered the heretofore uncataloged copy of Boyce's notes in manuscript Harrell 750. Quote, "The circumstances of finding this copy and the notes are worth noting because they relate to the proliferation of copies suggested here. Manuscript Harrell 750 is one of five, at least there may be others, manuscripts in the British Library that contain a copy of an order agreed upon for the translation of the Bible." Now let's stop there. Do you remember a few weeks ago when I showed you pictures of the rules and the companies and how they were broken out? I brought in a book and I showed you pictures of that. Those are also pictures of other things that are in this MS Harrell 750. So this is a cache of documents that are all related to the publication of the King, the translational work, etc., on the King James Bible. And included in that is this copy of the Notes of Boyce. Is everybody following that? Okay. Like the other three, I'm not going to read the call letters there, okay? This is followed by the rules to be observed in translation. These are central records of the King James Bible. It was in the course of checking them that I noticed in the same hand the uncataloged copy of Boyce's notes beginning on the next folio. So imagine sitting in the library looking at these documents, Harrell 750, MS Harrell 750, and reading about the first two items, which would have been the order agreed upon for the translation of the Bible, followed by the rules observed in translation, and turning the page and running across this and being like, well, that's in the same handwriting. And then studying it and realizing that what you're looking at is a, before this, unknown copy of Boyce's notes. So in other words, no one had realized before Norton what they were looking at when they looked at this. Are you guys with me? I'm trying to explain it as easy as I can, because all of this is important. Using the extant clues, Dr. Norton believes that the copy of Boyce's notes in manuscript Harrell 750 were made from Boyce's own copy. So does he think this copy was made directly from Boyce's own notes? That's what he's going to assert here in a second, all right? Further, he says that this had to have happened between 1626 and 1636. Now, he's got reasons for that, as we'll see in a second, okay? So what Norton has concluded, based upon his analysis, is that the copy of Boyce's notes in MS Harrell 750 is a copy that had been made directly from Boyce's own what? Own notes. Is everybody with me? So what does he say about it? Quote, "What the several manuscripts show is a 17th century interest in preserving and copying material relating to the King James Bible. Manuscript Harrell 750 and Fulman's manuscript extend this interest to one other major document, Boyce's notes. And MS Harrell 750 goes further. On the same leaf as the last of Boyce's notes, there begins in Waterburn's hand a copy of Boyce's," and then I'm not even going to try to pronounce the Latin name of this book that's 10 words long, okay? But understand what he's saying, okay? So imagine on the same page. So I'll just try to illustrate this for you, okay? Imagine that this paragraph ends Boyce's notes. On the same leaf, on the same page, is the beginning of another document which is this one here that is named, the name of which is given to you in Latin. So whoever is copying this, they're copying Boyce's notes, and then are they immediately beginning to hand copy another one of Boyce's books on the same page? You following that? So I'm just using this as an illustration of what I'm talking about and what Norton is trying to get his readers to understand. Since it was not published until 1655, Waterburn must have copied from a manuscript. Now understand what he's saying. This book by Boyce was not published in print until 1655. Yet manuscript Harl 750 contains a handwritten copy of a book that had not been printed until 1655. So that means then that he has to be copying the handwritten original of Boyce, who wrote that book, but it wasn't published until 1655. So that means then that whatever he's copying in the same hand on the same page, he is probably copying directly from documents that had been owned by who? Boyce. You following that? This is where you gotta think with me, okay? That manuscript was probably Boyce's own, for the two men certainly knew each other. Now here's the connection. Waterburn was made canon of Ely? How would you say that?
Ely.
Sometime before Christmas, 1626. By which time, Boyce had been prebend of Ely for more than a decade. Okay? So are these two serving in official church function capacities now in the same area at the same time? You with me? So do they know each other? For more than a decade. That Waterburn should have kept someone else's copy of the list of translators and their instructions and of Boyce's notes, and that he should have added to them his own copy of Boyce's further work, indicates an interest in both the King James Bible and his senior at Ely. Ely, whatever we're saying here. What are we saying? Ely? Ely, whatever.
Ely.
We'll go with Ely. Mike says Ely, it's Ely, okay? Now, the Ely connection and the fact that Fulman contains nothing of substance that is not also found in manuscript Harl 750. Here's the point, okay? These two documents, the Fulman manuscript, utilized by Ward Allen in his 1969 book, and manuscript Harl 750, are they substantively the same in all the details of what they're communicating? Now, there are minor variants of different spellings and those kinds of things, but look at the paragraph here, top of page 5. The Ely connection and the fact that Fulman contains nothing of substance that is not also found in manuscript Harl 750. So that means, are both of these copies of Boyce's notes substantively the same in what they contain? They're formatted differently, they're copied differently, but are they containing the same information? Okay? Makes it probable that the copy of Boyce's notes in manuscript Harl 750 was made from Boyce's own copy and came into Waterburn's hands at Ely. From the man himself, he added the Cotiello, that long Latin title. It also allows one to guess that this edition was made between 1626 and at least 1636, when Waterburn became Bishop of Dublin. The notes themselves must of course have been copied earlier. Okay? So now we have two copies of Boyce's notes. One, published access granted in 1969. A second, discovered in mid-1990s and talked about and collated by Norton in 1996. Despite believing that the notes found in manuscript Harl 750 were, quote, a first-hand copy of Boyce's original, Dr. Norton asks why the Fulman copy, reproduced by Allen, I'm sorry, he doesn't ask. Should say addresses why, I believe. He addresses why the Fulman copy, reproduced by Allen, will continue to be, quote, the primary source for Boyce's notes. So in other words, if this one is older, presumably taken from Boyce's own notes, why will this one, the Fulman manuscript reproduced by Ward Allen, continue to be sort of the standard one that everybody uses? You follow what I'm saying? Okay? So here's what he says about that. So let me read that again. Despite believing that the notes found in Harl Manuscript 750 were, quote, a first-hand copy of Boyce's original, Dr. Norton, what did I say we change that to? Addresses why the Fulman copy reproduced by Allen will continue to be, quote, the primary source for Boyce's notes, quote. He says this, the probability, which I assume is fact, that manuscript Harl 750 is a first-hand copy of Boyce's original would seem to give it more authority than Fulman's copy of a faulty copy. You following that? Okay? Comparisons, however, tend to favor Fulman. So there's aspects of Fulman's work that are better in that, and here they are. Number one, his Latin is better. His Latin is better. And particularly, his Greek is better than that of manuscript Harl 750 copies. So even though the copyist of manuscript 750 on the board behind me is copying from Boyce's own notes, he is less precise, less exact in his use of Latin and Greek, even though he is copying from Boyce himself, presumably, than Fulman was, who copied a faulty copy. So in other words, are there superiorities in the Fulman copy in terms of the precision of the Latin and the Greek than what are in manuscripts Harl 750? Okay? Overall, there are few variants where manuscript Harl 750 is more likely to be right than Fulman. Consequently, the primary effect of manuscript Harl 750 is to confirm the value of Fulman's work. Without further discoveries, his copy, Fulman's copy that is, will remain the primary source for Boyce's notes. Is everybody following that?
Mm-hmm.
Now, another reason I would add is quite simply, whose copy do we have published access to? This one, the Fulman copy, not the Harl 750 copy. Okay? So, Norton's essay contains 6 pages of discussion noting the primary variance between manuscript Harl 750 and the Fulman-Allen manuscript. So I'm calling it there the Fulman-Allen manuscript because Ward Allen, in 1969, is reproducing Fulman's manuscript. Okay? Exact photos of it. So, Norton's essay contains 6 pages of discussion noting the primary variance between manuscript Harl 750 and the Fulman-Allen manuscript. For our purposes in this lesson, a couple of summary observations will suffice. Look, guys, if you're not already bored, I could certainly accommodate you to go through every one of these variants, okay? Let me just show you what I'm talking about. So here's Norton's essay from 1996, and you can see right here at the top it says Table of Principal Variants, and he's got 2 columns, manuscript Harl 750 and Fulman. And all he's doing is noting the different minor variants between the 2 manuscripts. Now, and that goes on for 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9 pages. I don't need to go through all that with you for you to get the point of what I'm talking about, okay? So look at the bottom of page 5. The extent of the 2 manuscripts is identical. Meaning, do they contain all the same information? Yes. But manuscript Harl 750 supplies a small amount of material not found in Holman. So the extent of Romans through Revelation, it's the same, okay? There are innumerable minor variants, usually of spelling, punctuation, and Greek accentuation. And there is one significant difference of format. Manuscript Carl 750 gives the references to the verses under discussion in the margin, whereas Fulman gives them at the beginning of the note. So look at what I'm talking about here, okay? So here's Carl 750. Where are the references at? So here's 1 Corinthians, and where are the references noted? In the margin, okay? If we compare Fulman, notice that Fulman's formatting is different because he's giving the references right there for each note. So he's got the same information, he's just formatted it what? Differently, okay? There are several reasons for thinking that manuscript Harl 750 reflects Boyce's original format. So, he's saying that this one is probably the original format of Boyce, and he's going to give you a few reasons why. Okay, occasionally it misplaces the reference and a line is drawn to note from note to reference. Since the references are in the same hand, and so not somebody else's later edition, it seems likely that Boyce gave the references in this way, either his lineation was not always clear, or the manuscript Harl 750 copyist sometimes added the references separately. Fulman probably checked and revised the references since there are a number of instances where he supplies references omitted in manuscript Harl 750. Very occasionally, manuscript Harl 750 gives a reference omitted in Fulman. Also, Fulman's marginal lettering indicates that the additional notes at the end of the manuscript fit with the rest of the notes are not present in manuscript Harl 750. Presumably, these are Fulman's addition. The clearest evidence that manuscript Harl 750 represents Boyce's own arrangement is in 1 Timothy 1:6 and 18. Fulman has placed the division between the two notes in the wrong place and consequently failed to understand the significance of what he takes to be the end of the first note. The presentation in manuscript Harl 750, see the table of variants for these verses, sufficiently explains Fulman's mistake. So, the bottom line is, are both the documents covering the same information? Are they just laid out differently? Fulman appears to have done it more neatly, if I could say it that way. So, from whatever he was copying. Prior to the table of principal variants, and again, that's this right here, is what I'm referring to there. Prior to the table of principal variants, between manuscript Harl 750 and Fulman, Dr. Norton concludes his essay with the following words. He says, quote, "As well as helping to prove that Fulman did not work from either manuscript Harl 750 or Boyce's original, the examples show the kind of insight that can be gained from putting the two manuscripts together. Moreover, they are a reminder of the importance of Boyce's notes as a whole for appreciation of the scholarship of the translators and the care with which they weighed the words of the original and of its most important translation in the English language." Okay? So, has anybody got any questions about that? Yeah, Bart.
Could it be that because there was the overlap in time where he was taking over the position that Boyce had, and Boyce hadn't had his papers published yet, that he was making a copy, so when he left he would still have the original?
I mean, that seems like reasonable speculation.
Maybe.
But we probably will never know for sure. But yeah, that seems reasonable. So understand, for a time, Boyce is the superior of Waterburn, who made the copy. Boyce is older than Waterburn. Eventually, Boyce dies, and Waterburn gets appointed and moves on to a different position. But while he's there, he appears to be copying directly the work of Boyce on at least a few things.
His would be the only copy of his notes, I would assume, at that time.
Waterburn's copy of Boyce's notes, to our knowledge, is the only direct copy of Boyce's notes. Other material that Boyce wrote that were in those notes that Waterburn is copying was later published in a book form on a press. Yeah. So, the following summary of the notes of Boyce, the following is a summary of the notes of Boyce like the ones provided above. Okay? So I've got the same structure. The notes of Boyce had been lost to history.
So I don't know where I'm going to write Boyce. I guess I could go over here. I don't know if it'll show up on the camera. But Boyce's notes are lost to history, okay?
Scribner noted in his 1844 book, The Authorized Edition of the English Bible, 1611, that Boyce and he alone had taken notes at the general meeting at Stationers Hall during the years of 1610 to 1611. Gustavus Payne also included a photograph and some remarks of John Boyce and his notes in his 1959 work, The Learned Men. Okay? So, I'm going to say over here that Boyce's notes were largely lost to what?
History.
To history. Okay? Try to follow a similar format to what we did over there. In 1844, or 1884, Scribner mentions the Boyce notes and says they're basically what? Lost. Okay? 1959, Payne, Gustavus Payne, publishes The Learned Men and includes a photo of a page of Boyce's notes with minor comment. Okay? That is going to prompt Ward Allen to go and dig deeper to see if he can get lay his hands and his eyes on what Payne has published in the book from 1959. Okay, so let's go back to this. I don't want to miss anything. Scholarly awareness. Ward Allen, in the mid-1960s, working with the library, working with the librarian of Corpus Christi College, Oxford, was able to locate and confirm a copy of Boyce's lost notes. Allen published a preliminary description of the document in the winter, should say 1966, edition of the Renaissance News. So 1966, Allen is going to publish what he believes, he's announcing there to the scholarly world, that he believes he has found Boyce's lost what?
Notes.
And he submits it for comment to the literary scholastic world of the mid-1960s. People come back and give their assessment of that. Published access is the next point. Then in 1969, it's Allen again, who is going to publish Translating for King James. And in Translating for King James, as I've already shown you, just to refresh your memory, he reproduces photographic images of the Fulman manuscript along with an English translation on the facing page in his 1969 book. So at this point now, does the public have access to the document through a published work, notably this one right here? And notice, when is that happening? What year? 69. So now let's look at our years here. When do people first know about MS-98? 1955, published and talked about by Willoughby in 1956. When do people first know for sure what they're looking at in Bot 1602? It's not until 1955 and the published work of Willoughby in 1956. Remember that Westcott and Pocock, they knew about it, but they didn't identify what it was and the significance of it, right? Now we come over here with the notes of Boyce. When is it speculated that the lost notes have been discovered? Allen is announcing that in his winter 1966 publication for the Renaissance News, and he is publishing full public access to it in 1969. So it is not until the late, it's not until the middle of the 1950s and the late 1960s that the scholarly world is even aware. Public access to manuscript 98 is not granted until 1977 through the publication of Ward Allen. In the case of Bod 1602, it's not really granted until 1995 through a joint publication of Ward Allen and Jacobs. And in the case of Boyce's notes, it does occur, though, in 1969 through the publication there. But the point is, have many King James, pro-King James books already been written at this point that have no awareness, much less understanding of what is in these documents we're discussing? Okay? So let's finish the point. In 1969, Allen granted public access to the document, speaking now about Boyce's notes, via the publication of Translating for King James, notes made by a translator of the King James Bible. Allen's book contained images of the document along with an English translation of its entirety. I've showed you pictures of that now twice in this lesson. In 1996, Professor David Norton announced the discovery of a second copy, manuscript Harl 750, in the British Library, in his piece for the librarian titled The Boyce, John Boyce's Notes, a Revision of the King James Bible, New Testament, a New Manuscript. Now, we will consider what else can be gleaned from Allen's work on the notes of Boyce in a future lesson. For now, suffice it to say that yet another primary work in progress document was not known or studied by the early articulators of what became the King James only movement in the United States. Okay? Now, you guys know where I'm coming from. I am squarely a King James advocate. We only teach from and preach from in this church a King James Bible. Okay? But I am acknowledging the fact that in the pro-King James argumentation were many things said without knowing any of this information. And what I am now saying is I think certain things need to be rethought, revised based upon light that is shed on the process from these documents. Okay? Now, next week, we're going to look now at some more documents. I just found out this week that between 2015 and today, some more things have been discovered in British libraries. So I've spent the better part of the week studying and researching about that. And we're going to talk about that next week and maybe even the week after about what that information is and how that can further illuminate for us what was going on. Okay? And again, folks, I'm not doing all this to try your patience. I'm doing all of this so that we can establish some teaching that is reasonably complete. It's never going to be perfect. It's never going to have everything, but it will be as complete and up-to-date as we can have it be in 2022. Okay? All right, so I am going to start closing the stream down. I'm going to pack up the equipment. If anybody has a question, by all means, make sure you ask. Those of you that have joined us online, we appreciate you tuning into our live stream, and or if you're watching it after the fact, we appreciate it. Make sure that you reach out if you have any questions or comments. Like this.